Good morning, everyone. It's good to be back with you. Been gone a couple of weeks, and it's good to be here Wednesday, and good to be back preaching this morning. I appreciate those that spoke while I was gone. I think you would have probably been speaking anyway, but I still thank you for doing that in my absence, and I appreciate your efforts. If you would, in your Bibles this morning, turn to John chapter 11, and a passage I'm going to read this story, and it's one that is well known, probably for several reasons, but probably one of the primary reasons that this story is well known is because within that you have a phrase that has become, I guess, popularized, probably for the wrong reasons, but the statement that Jesus wept. Unfortunately, the reason that it's been popularized is for a totally irrelevant reason, and that is, well, that's the shortest verse in the Bible. Well, that's totally arbitrary because that could have very easily been added to the verse to follow, and if that had happened, probably that statement would not have the attention that it does. And that, of course, would have been would be unfortunate as well. And I do want to talk about that this morning, about Jesus crying in this particular situation, and explore that and how that relates to us. Now, I'm going to alter my introduction a little bit because David, in leading us in a prayer just a moment ago, he ended his prayer with really a corollary point to what we're going to be talking about this morning, as he prayed about us indeed looking ahead and forward to being with God in heaven. And I guess the question I'll ask, not only the question of why did Jesus weep, but then a question for you to ponder this morning is, do you want to leave this earth and be with God? And that might sound on one hand like a question that has an obvious rhetorical answer. Well, of course I do. But if you think about how people live this life, and that includes us as Christians, do we really make that statement that, yes, I believe in Jesus and I want to be with him? Or do we live our life and say and do things that actually indicate, you know what, I don't want to die. I don't want to leave this earth. I'm very sad and upset when somebody leaves this earth, and I don't want to be one of them. And I've become concerned, I'll be honest with you, the last couple of years has led me to give serious consideration to not only my adherence and loyalty to this world, but I see concerning things that indicate that a lot of people don't want to leave this world, and they live their life in fear, when, if they're Christians, they should not have that fear. And maybe Satan has betrayed our thinking to the reality that really we love this world more than we maybe say we do, but it's indicated and shown by just the way we act when certain things happen in this life. And you might say, well, what does that have to do with Lazarus? Well, hopefully as we explore this text, you'll see it has everything to do with Lazarus. And I think it relates to why Jesus cried. Because a lot of times people think, well, Jesus cried because, well, Lazarus died. Is that really why Jesus wept? Is that really all that's going on here? Is that he just got sucked up into the emotions of a funeral? Or is there something else going on here? Well, let's start out by just reading the story. Beginning in John chapter 11, and we'll start at verse 1. It says, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. And so the sisters sent word to Jesus, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. And when Jesus heard this, he said, This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And so when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. And then after this, he was saying to his disciples, "Well, let us go to Judea again." And the disciples were saying to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going to go there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." And he said, after that, he was saying to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep." The disciples then said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, well, he will recover." Now, Jesus had spoken, of course, of his death, but they thought that he was speaking of literal sleep. And so Jesus then said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sake that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him." Therefore, Thomas, who is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she had heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus was saying to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha was saying to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. And everyone who lives believes in me and will never die. Do you believe this?" She was saying to him, "Yes, Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." When she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here, and he's calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but he was in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were there with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came to where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus therefore saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled, and said, "Where have you laid him?" And they were saying to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews were saying, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" And so Jesus, again being deeply moved within, he came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. And Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha and the sister of the deceased said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus was saying to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" And so they removed the stone, and Jesus raised his eyes, and he said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And the man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. And Jesus was saying to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Well, as we consider this story and even the specific points that I want to talk about this morning, they do indeed provide us a valuable insight into aspects of Jesus that maybe we don't contemplate without. We certainly see the aspect of Jesus' capacity for the human emotion of compassion and love, of care and concern for what is going on around him. We see that Jesus is indeed the Son of God, yet entered into wholly and completely the aspect of humanity, the condition of humanity. Jesus was not just God that was still somewhat aloof and somewhat detached from humanity. He really was God in the flesh. He really was engaged in every aspect of humanity that we engage in. Sometimes maybe that is overshadowed by our, again, clarification that we will often make, well, yet without sin. Well, that's certainly true, but that without sin does not diminish his humanity in any respect. Indeed, the point of the Hebrew writer is that among many points that Jesus' humanity was indeed a part of the his high priesthood, the fact that he indeed does fulfill the role of that connection between us and God, and that he is that merciful and faithful high priest. Particularly, pay attention to Hebrews chapter 2. I won't read that this morning, but you read Hebrews 2, you see that point, and subsequent sections of Hebrews to emphasize that, yes, there is a commonality not only with his nature as God, but his commonality with us as his fellow brethren, as his fellow human. And we often cite John 11:35 as an example of that point, and rightly so. We certainly see that as an example of the capacity that Jesus has to relate to the people that is around him. But as we consider that, we do come to the question of, well, what really is going on here? And what is producing the emotion that we see demonstrated by Jesus on this occasion? The preceding verses certainly tell us that he saw Mary weeping, and he sees the Jews weeping. Perhaps we would then suppose that, well, he just, got impacted by that he got affected by that. And, we certainly relate to that, and maybe we interpret this passage in that, and what I would ultimately say, a limited way, because we ourselves have experienced that. Maybe you are in perfect control of your emotions, and you walk into a situation where it is the opposite of that, and it impacts you. It's like, once somebody starts crying, well, then it kind of, you can see the domino effect, as it were, and maybe some that may be like, oh, well, I'm okay, I'm fine, but then somebody else starts weeping, and, well, it affects you too. And so then you have tears. Is that all that's really going on here? Is that the simple explanation? That's certainly one thing that we see. We see the explanation that the people around were thinking is that, well, he loved Lazarus. And so it wasn't just being affected by somebody else's tears, but the tears actually were from within, that it was actually a love that he had for Lazarus, and that he is indeed crying because he loved somebody he loved is now gone. And again, maybe there's a certain level of legitimacy to that interpretation, but again, I ask, is that really all that's going on here? Is it just tears of a typical human situation, and that somebody who had been around that he loved is now not around anymore. Well, the problems with those simple explanations is that they don't really take into account the entirety of Jesus' state of mind. That clearly is indicated throughout the story, to the point that Jesus doesn't immediately drop everything and travel to Bethany. He stays away for two more days after the news comes. That has to be considered in all of this. You know, was the weeping simply because that he knew that death had occurred and he loved Lazarus and you know, Lazarus is dead and the Jews are crying and upset. Mary and Martha are crying and are upset. And Jesus is just, you know, crying for the same reasons they were. I just have to challenge that thinking entirely. Because we see even as early as the message receiving, he says in verse 4, this sickness is not to end in death. What does that tell me about the state of mind of Jesus? That the typical emotion that would overcome someone in a situation of death is frankly removed from this situation. Because Jesus knows what he's going to do. He knows that Lazarus is going to die even before anybody else did. And he knows that there is a purpose that he is going to be carrying out. And that is, as he says here, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Jesus knows what's going to happen. He knows that Lazarus is going to come back to life. So whatever the reasons of the weeping, it is not limited to simply being sad because Lazarus died. Because he knows, I'm going to raise him. And even as he's standing there outside of the community where he meets Martha, again, he knows that he's going to go to the body and he's going to raise that body from the dead. He knows that the spirit, the soul of Lazarus is going to be reunited with his body and he's going to return to this world. And so as we consider all of this, particularly the compassion of Jesus, we won't debate that. I don't think we have to, honestly. We know that Jesus loves us, right? We know that Jesus had that, you know, God is love, right? I mean, there's not really any reason to say, well, I've got to have this passage to demonstrate that Jesus was a man of love. No, you don't need this passage. The passage you need to demonstrate that is the passage that says that Jesus died for our sins. The passage that you need for that is this, the passage that understands the compassion and love of God. Jesus is that. So really, we're talking about something here that goes beyond the compassion of Jesus. As much as that is indeed an important point, as much as that is indeed there, Jesus crying is not really what demonstrates his compassion and love. After all, we all know that people can cry in a situation and they not even know the person. I've done that. I've been sent to, in my secular job, I've been sent to a number of funerals over the years. And I don't know anybody there. And I don't know the person that they're there to remember. I'm there to, you know, carry out an official, letter of sympathy or something like that. But yet, as I'm sitting there, yeah, I can weep. Kevin weeping in that situation isn't because, well, he must have been a friend with the person that's in the casket. No, didn't know him. Have no connection whatsoever. So yes, weeping can be a factor that happens to us on an emotional level, but that in and of itself does not necessarily and inherently demonstrate love. I don't need this passage to talk about the love of Jesus. There are many, many more substantive passages that would indicate that. So it still takes me back to then, but nevertheless, Jesus did weep, so why? As we consider the placement of this statement, Jesus wept, it's not really where we would expect it to occur. if it were merely a human emotion that is being carried out. Again, Jesus has already referred to the death of Lazarus back in verses 11 through 13. It wasn't like Jesus arrived and then was met with the news suddenly and unexpectedly, Lazarus is dead. Oh, I didn't know that. And then he is overwhelmed with emotion. No, he already knew. In fact, he told his disciples. And note earlier in the text that the disciples themselves are not really concerned about Lazarus. In fact, what are they concerned about? Do you really want to go to Judea? The people down there just tried to stone you. I think from their perspective, they understood, for the wrong reasons, they understood why Jesus didn't immediately go to Judea. They were thinking, well, he doesn't want to go to Judea because it's dangerous down there for him. In fact, when Jesus finally does say, let us go to Judea again, they're like, why do you want to do that? So the context of their travels to Bethany actually had little to do with any friendship or connection with this family. Now, Jesus is thinking about this family, but Jesus is thinking about much more. Jesus is thinking about what is going to be demonstrated and what he's going to do in regard to Lazarus. He knows Lazarus has died even before they leave. He tells them he's fallen asleep. They don't understand the metaphor of that. And so he just says plainly, he's dead. So Jesus knows. If somebody is going to cry simply because of a lost loved one, well, when would you have cried? When you knew he died. And he doesn't. He doesn't cry until he gets there and he starts talking to the sisters. He doesn't cry until he gets there and he sees what is going on in this period of grieving. That's when we're told that he weeps. Furthermore, as we look at this, as early as verse 4, he is stated that this sickness is not going to ultimately end in death. Now, normally when you make a statement like that, and again, what the presumption of the sisters was, well, if you had been here, it would not have been a sickness unto death because you could heal him and you could have prevented. He would not have died. Far away, Jesus is saying this, not because he's intending to go to heal him, but he says this because, yes, he's going to die, and I'm going to raise him from the dead. That is the premise of the entire story. A premise that the disciples did not know. A premise that Mary and Martha certainly did not know. And a premise that none of the other people in the community of Bethany knew. In fact, they even used that against him. Well, they join in. If you had been here, he wouldn't have died. Hopefully you're thinking about that question. Why did Jesus weep when he arrives and starts talking to the people? As we look at this, we say that Jesus knew long before that he wept that he would raise Lazarus from the dead. A clue, I think, to why Jesus reacts the way he does, I think, is actually given in verse 15. After Jesus says to them plainly, Lazarus is dead, notice what else Jesus says to, and again, this is to his disciples, I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. I don't know how much thought you've ever given to that part of the story, but I think that's actually a very very insightful and clue to what really is going on in the mind of Jesus. He is saying and understanding that if I had been there, there would have been maybe the healing of the sick. But there's something more that Jesus is trying to get at, and it says so that you may believe. What does he mean by that? I thought, don't the disciples believe in Jesus? Don't they believe in Jesus? And later on, the same thing with Mary and Martha. He says something, so that you may believe. Don't Mary and Martha believe? And so that gets me to thinking and to realize here is that the faith that Jesus is referring to here is a faith that is growing and becoming more than what it was. We often make the mistake of thinking that faith is a very basic, fundamental thing that, you know, we just, once we have it, we have it. Oh, I believe. I believe in Jesus. And we fail to recognize that faith actually, when you really understand what faith in anything really is, it's more complex than that. In fact, it demands a process of growth. The faith that the disciples had at this time was not everything they needed. It was not a complete, mature faith. It was actually still very childlike. And the same with Mary and Martha. Maybe you're beginning to catch on to where I'm going with this. Why did Jesus weep? It has to do with what he's seeing in regard to their faith. In verse 23, Jesus again affirms that he is going to raise Lazarus from the dead. And in the process, he is testing the faith of Martha. And Martha, of course, responds in a way that I think we can relate to. You notice that she finally says to him, "Lord, I have believed that you are the Christ and the Son of God, and even he who comes in the world." Martha's like very precise and direct. "I know who you are." To the point that you might say that, well, Martha's not an issue here. Martha's faith is great. Martha's faith is fine. She believes that he's the Messiah. She believes that he is the Son of God. She believes that even he is God in the flesh. I think that's what she means by he who comes into the world. Martha's like, she's there. I would suggest to you that the story, however, indicates that no, she's not. Faith, yes, but mature and complete, no. Because she's still hanging on to something. She's still hanging on to the same thing the disciples still hung on to. Which is indicated earlier by saying what? "Jesus, you don't want to go there, why?" "Well, they might kill you." "Well, we don't want you dead." "Jesus, you, if you were here, you could have healed my brother." "I don't want him dead." What are these people missing? And this gets back to my corollary question based on David's prayer this morning. "I don't want to die." "I don't want you to die." "I don't want to die." We didn't want Lazarus to die. It's terrible that he died. We're so upset that he died. If you had been here, Jesus, he wouldn't have died. "Jesus, don't go there. You might die." See? See the commonality of what's going on in this story? Even though there is a expressed, even in the case of Martha, a verbalized confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of God. You are indeed the one that we've been looking for. I believe in you. But Jesus, I still want to be here. Jesus, I still want my brother here. I don't want my brother to be gone." That's when Jesus weeps. That's when Jesus begins not just to weep, but we see something else happening here. Throughout the disciples' time with Jesus, they continually expose their lack of fully developed faith in a number of stories. And I think this is another one of those to add to that. And Mary and Martha kind of join in that particular analysis of you know, those that follow Jesus, not only the 12, but then the others that we see that come and go throughout the ministry of Jesus. And Mary and Martha were certainly among the prominent ones that certainly did express faith in Jesus, and yet they also at times express an immaturity in their faith. And we see that expressed here. Faith, yes, but incomplete faith. They believed that he could have kept Lazarus from dying. They believed that he had the power to heal the sick. But when it comes to death, they didn't want anything to do with that. And I think the key verse here is verse 33. And for whatever reason, verse 33 is skipped over. I don't know why. I mean, it may be read, but when all of this is talked about, there's something said here that actually has more to do with the emotion of Jesus than this phrase, Jesus wept. Because the reality is the actual tears that they saw on the outside when they looked at Jesus and he was crying, and I don't know, you know, you can imagine Jesus doing whatever, I guess. Was he wailing or whatever? Or maybe he was just a few tears. Enough for them to say Jesus wept. But what statement actually shows the actual emotion? It's not verse 35. It's not verse 35. It's verse 33. Read verse 33. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, it says he was, quote, deeply moved in the spirit and was troubled. And I would suggest to you that is something that they did not see. That was something that was actually within the spirit, the soul of Jesus. Before the tears came out, there's this deep inward emotion. Now, what is that? Now, what do we equate weeping to generally? Well, he's sad. He loved Lazarus. And that's what they did. They saw him like, oh, well, look at how he loved Lazarus. And he's so sad that Lazarus has died. Is sadness what's moving Jesus here? I suggest to you it is not sadness at all. Not in the sense of just losing a loved one, but it is something deeper that is here. Something that helps me is to look at the words that are translated here that, again, the New American Standard that I'm reading in verse 33 is that he was deeply moved in the spirit and that he was troubled. The verb that is used here, that particularly the one about deeply moved, or maybe some of your versions say he groaned in the spirit, that is the same word that is used in other places, like Matthew chapter 9 and verse 30. And it's just interesting to go back and see these other occasions when Jesus was moved or groaned in the Spirit like this. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 30. It's translated here in an interesting way, because this is the story of a miracle of healing. And it says that he entered the house, back up in verse 28, the blind men came to him, and Jesus was saying to them, do you believe that I'm able to do this? And they said, yes, Lord. And he touched their eyes, saying, it shall be done with you according to your faith. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus, and then it says, Jesus sternly warned them. The verb where Jesus sternly warned them, that's the same word. It's here in John 11:33. Now that's interesting, isn't it? A word that in one context is just translated that, well, he's deeply moved or groaning. But in another context, it's in the context of being stern with someone. I find that interesting. Likewise, in Mark, just another example of this word, and you can do a more detailed study of this word on your own if you want. Mark chapter 1 and verse 43, again, in the context of a miracle occurring, this time not blindness but leprosy. It says, immediately the leprosy left him, the one he healed, in verse 42, and he was cleansed. But then it says, Jesus sternly warned him and immediately sent him away. Again, I'm connecting this idea of a deep emotion that might produce itself in the form of a weeping, or it produces itself in the form of a sternness and warning someone. What this tells me then is that this verb being used here is indicating something more going on within the mind of Jesus than merely, oh, Lazarus died. No. there is something really pushing at Jesus right now. Inwardly, he is deeply disturbed about something. And it goes beyond the death. The death that certainly he knew was coming and that he was going to take care of. So it really has nothing to do with that. It has to do with something else. So I'm challenging you right now. What is it? What really is it that's really pushing at Jesus on the inside? Interestingly, with Mary, this same word is used when he sternly criticizes her in another context in Mark chapter 14 and verse 3. And that goes back, remember, we're told that this is the same Mary that anointed him with the expensive oil, and he was rather upset. Or the others were upset, I should say, not Jesus, but they were very upset about that. And it shows that there's some deep emotion that's gripping Jesus. That's my point. Verse 38 in this context, again says Jesus was being deeply moved. That's the same word. Deeply moved within, he came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone was lying against it. There's something going on. Even after he's done with the tears, the weeping, he's getting ready to raise Lazarus from the dead. What I'm trying to get you to see is if this was merely being upset because a man had died, he wouldn't have still be experiencing this right before he says, "Lazarus, come forth." There's something else going on here. Well, enough of the suspense, right? What is it? What is really upsetting Jesus in this story? Why did he weep? Well, Jesus, unlike everybody else around him at this moment, he knows fully what's going on with Lazarus. Not only did he know more than the disciples back when he had died and the disciples didn't know that, not only did he know that Lazarus was going to die when he was sick, but yet it was not going to end in that death, he also has an understanding about things that we really don't, even though we have some scriptures that tell us about it. I believe Jesus knows fully about where Lazarus was at this moment. Where is Lazarus? Now, some of you might say, "Oh, well, he's in the tomb." No, where is Lazarus at this moment? Right before he says, "Lazarus, come on." Where is Lazarus? The body is in the tomb. Where is Lazarus? Lazarus has died. It would appear that Lazarus was a good man, like Mary and Martha, that he was a believer. Lazarus is in paradise. He is in what is described in Luke 16 as Abraham's bosom. Jesus knows that. Jesus knows that. He knows about the glories. He himself had been in the very presence of God himself. He left that to come and live on this earth. I believe there's two things that are driving at Jesus' emotion in this story. One is of just how attached everybody around is to this world and unaware and not really seeing the glories of where Lazarus is. And the fact that now, because their faith needed to be grown and made more complete, and he himself be glorified further in this miracle that he's getting ready to perform, he's going to have to bring Lazarus back into this terrible world. We're not told about what Lazarus thought about all this. I mean, can you imagine? You're in Abraham's bosom, and then Jesus says, "Lazarus, come forth," and you go back into your body, and here you are again. And Lazarus is going to go through sickness again. Lazarus is going to go through all that process, and Lazarus will die again. I say, poor Lazarus. but it was needed. It was absolutely essential because, again, I say this, he says, so that they may believe, so that their faith may actually grow and be complete. And so Jesus is upset, not just crying. He is deeply moved because he sees people who really, even though they have faith in God and faith in him, they really still do not see the true relationship with God in heaven that is to come. And they're wanting to avoid that. And they're wishing that Lazarus had not died. What is the application of all this to us? We try our very best to hold on to this world. I see people cowering in the corner because I don't want to get sick. I don't want to die. You're a Christian. What are you thinking? What are you thinking? We all face death. We face challenges of life. And yes, death is in our future. Paul said, for me to live is Christ. You know the rest of the verse, don't you? For me to live is Christ, but to die is gain. Now, I'm not here today promoting that, well, we just stop taking care of ourselves and just die. You know, live an unhealthy life so that death comes quicker. I'm not suggesting suicide. None of that. I'm talking about perspective. The perspective of our faith and our trust in God and our belief that, yes, he is the Christ, the Son of God. And how do we react to the woes of this world versus the lust of this world that we actually are still grabbing onto? I think about this. Even in my imperfection, my sin, my struggles with temptation, I do think about, well, how much am I really connected to this world? Do I really believe the words, this world is not my home? Do I really believe that? Do I really believe that my ultimate life is in the bosom of God, of Jesus, of Abraham? Do I really believe that that is my goal? Or do I still, I wonder if I still have two more decades. You know, you get into your 50s, it's like, you know, can I stretch out three? Can I get four? Can I double it? Can you give me five more decades, Lord? Is that the kind of thinking we're having? As Christians, yeah, that's wrong-headed. And again, I think our devotion to this world is revealed at times in very subtle, tricky ways by Satan. And I think Satan laughs a lot, and I think he's been laughing a lot over the last few years, of where people are desperately trying to hang on to something in this life, when really they should be looking ahead to the glories of God in heaven, to where we are indeed like Paul, where we acknowledge and not just, you know, and how did Paul say that? I guess I'll end with that point. Do we think Paul said, well, for me to live is Christ? Well, yeah, I guess to die is gain. Is that how Paul said it? No, he didn't say it that way. Paul was excited about that. And as he writes his final words in the final letter of 2 Timothy, we clearly see that Paul looked at his life as ultimately as a victory over this world. And to the point that Paul could look death, and it wasn't death that Paul might say, well, I don't know what, it might happen. There were times where Paul was looking at death and I think he actually got up and said, wow, I can't believe I'm still alive. And maybe he even got up from a stoning or two and said, you know what? I wish that had been the end. Here I got to go through this again. Paul suffered a number of, you might say, near-death experiences of being stoned, being in the shipwrecks. He says, day and nights in the sea. And he survived. And yet you see in the Philippian letter, I mean, he's like, you know, to die would be gain. I ask you, do you believe that this morning? We talk about, well, we have to have faith. I ask you, has your faith come to include the concept that that means I trust in God, that I will be with him for eternity, and it's not here on this earth? That this earth and everything connected with it is absolutely nothing. Family is important to us. This world that we live in is important to us. All kinds of things and aspects of our life are important to us. But that importance has to be made secondary. I'm not convinced that Christians and people in general successfully bring that down, to the point that many people elevate something, and maybe several somethings, as supreme. And they, whatever those things are, they're your God. You are worshiping those things. It might be your family. It might be your job. It might just be my good old everyday life. It may be any number of things. Put that false God away. If you say you're a Christian and you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that must be supreme. And this world is not your home. And you are just passing through. And when you do face death, you face that death with confidence, whether it's the death of someone else or it's your own. And I know, I'm giving you a hard task right now. That is so difficult. Because it's easy for us to say in this context, oh yeah, I believe in heaven. I believe I'm going to be with Jesus, and I want to go and be with Jesus. Well, if you're being stoned to death, would you be saying that? If you were in the deep, would you be saying that? If a loved one had died like Lazarus, would you be saying that? Would you be saying, Jesus, if you had just been here, he wouldn't have died? Or would you be saying, my brother is in heaven. My brother is in paradise. My brother is in a better place. And I know people do say that sometimes. I just hope it's really meant. When you say that someone's in a better place, I hope you mean that. And that you're not secretly still saying, well, I wish he was still here. My parents are gone. I have hope that my parents are with Jesus. They're with God. And I'm okay with that. I would not want them to be resurrected back into this world. What I want them to be is the resurrected in that bodily resurrection that's described in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians and 1 Thessalonians. That's the resurrection I want for my parents. I don't want them to have to come through and live this life again. I wouldn't want to come back like Lazarus did. I'm glad that he did, because it teaches me about faith. But the eternal life is what it's really about. Michael, what song are we going to sing here? You would take your blue hymnals out and turn to 177. We'll be singing a few songs here about some of these points that Michael has selected. And as you can see here, this song, when you get there, is about our life. But notice it starts out. Brief life is here, our portion. Brief sorrow, short-lived care. The life that knows no ending, the tearless life is there. And you can see from that opening verse of the theme of this song. And I just simply want to connect this to your faith. Do you live your life as this song depicts, or do you live your life as, well, this life is all there is? Each and every one of you, those of you that are younger, and all of us that are older, we have a multitude of friends that we interact with on a day-to-day basis that live their life as if this life is all there is. And everything they do and everything they think is about just this world, this life. And you see the sadness and the disappointment and the frustration and the stress that goes along with that. You don't have to live that way. If you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, then you can live your life like this song and many other hymns that we have portray our life. And ultimately, it's a life that is in Christ. As we sing this song, if there is anything that we can do to help you in your being in a relationship with God, we stand ready to do that, whether to be baptized into Christ or whether it simply be to pray for you, to help you study more about God's will, anything like that. But I mostly want each and every one of us to think about our faith and make sure that we really do have a mature faith that has left this world behind, and we're not clinging to it like Mary and Martha and the other people at the tomb of Lazarus. Please think about these things as we stand and as we sing.